You are listening to The Bill Podcast with me, Natalie Rolls. Brought to you in association with georgefairbrother.com, shop.saturdaymorningpress.co.uk, cityfiction.co.uk, and vanguardcomics.co.uk.
Hello and welcome to The Bill Podcast with me, Oliver Crocker. We're going old school today, as Natalie is currently away filming. She's been back in front of the camera on a few projects lately, and I'm really delighted. She's a superb actress, as well as being a great podcast host, and I'm really pleased that she's in demand. And I'm so grateful for her support of The Bill Podcast. Since she's been presenting, the popularity of the show has really grown. We've now been played over 400,000 times in 50 countries worldwide. And I can't tell you how supportive and enthusiastic Natalie has been. She's recorded some terrific interviews, and the upcoming trilogy with Paul Marquis is one of the best podcasts I've ever heard, let alone produced. But before then, I'm delighted to bring you this bonus edition of The Bill Podcast. I had the huge pleasure of chatting to my friend and our sponsor, Michael Seeley of Saturday Morning Press. Michael is a brilliant TV historian, and in this podcast, we chat about how he got started as a researcher and author, and we also trade stories about some of our adventures tracking down contributors and writing books. I'm also particularly excited to hear about Michael's visit to the BBC Written Archives. We also chat about The Bill, and Michael shares some memories of his experiences as a viewer over the years. At the end, I'll be sharing details of Michael's upcoming book releases. Before then, here's Natalie reading a special promo for one of his latest tomes, Taste and Decency, The Swizzlewick Story.
In 1963, the BBC tried something different with a new soap opera. Rather than create another Coronation Street, emerging playwright David Turner devised Swizzlewick, a bold, satirical comedy set within a Midlands town council, populated by outrageous stereotypes with enormous character flaws. Its broadcast in 1964 outraged local government and panicked the BBC, who soon came under fire from Mary Whitehouse's Clean Up TV campaign. What happened next? Find out in Michael Seeley's brilliant book, Taste and Decency, The Swizzlewick Story. Out now from shop.saturdaymorningpress.co.uk.
Michael, welcome, and thank you for your support of The Bill Podcast. Tell me all about Saturday Morning Press.
It's been like a year in development, as you well know. It's designed simply so that I can publish the stuff that no one else will touch because it isn't really commercially viable. And I had to hurry it along because I wanted to sponsor Bill Podcast and Letter from Helvetica. And I thought, if I don't get something out in April, it'll be completely and utter waste of time. The Doomwatch script book, the reprint of Deadly Dangerous Tomorrow.
It's a gorgeous book.
Thank you. Yeah, Rob Hammond did the cover. Wasn't it a great cover?
It's a stunning cover. It's but sat proudly behind me.
Yeah, lovely. He's very good with a brief. He just gets it right first time. Yeah, that's the whole purpose of Saturday Morning Press. It's to publish books on a very obscure 1960s or perhaps not so obscure 1960s television programmes or 1970s television programmes. I wouldn't mind doing Dixon of Dot Green one day.
Absolutely.
Well, the anniversary, of course. Of the, was it 60th? It must be 60th anniversary.
Well, it will be 70th.
70th? Yeah, my maths is dreadful. Yeah, of course it is, because Doctor Who's... I'm still stuck 10 years ago.
Yeah.
It'll be the 70th anniversary. So I wouldn't mind doing a decent, proper book on the development of the series. Was it last, how long did it last for? You're the expert. How long did it last for?
21 years.
21 years. And it started off as light entertainment. And it eventually graduated to the drama department. But I think quite late in the day, because I was looking at the file of writer N.J. Crisp, who wrote quite a lot of them.
Yes, he did.
And I think a lot of those contracts I saw were light entertainment contracts, even into the mid-60s. I'm sure David Brunt can give you chapter and verse on this. But some of the later ones were proper series department contracts. So it was quite late in the day, I think, it actually became a fully fledged. But I like to investigate it. I want to read the scripts, and that's going to be a long process, that is. There's some good production files on it, and trace the development of the series and see how many myths we can lay to bear, which is always a fun of research, isn't it?
Well, research is addictive, but for the benefit of those, and indeed me, because I've never been, for the benefit of people listening to this, the BBC has a research archive, doesn't it?
Caversham, near Reading.
So bring that to life for us. How, talk us through the process and what you can find there. What's it like going to Caversham and the BBC archive?
Well, I'm going there again in a few months' time to research two 1960s BBC soaps, one that failed miserably, 199 Park Lane, and Compact, which was the one that the BBC were quite ashamed of, but was quite popular. I thought it was about time, especially Compact had a book devoted to it, to see, was it as bad as people say it was? Or if it was bad, why did it run on for so long? You know, 3 years. It has had some quite good cast. Remember Carmen Severa? Or was it Severa? Bill Kerr from Hancock's Half Hour, he was in it. So I can't wait. Can't wait to do that. No preconceived ideas at the moment. I'm just going to see what the research... That's what you do when you write a book. You let the research dictate the book. Not the other way around. Yeah. Otherwise, you might as well not bother. You might as well just make stuff up.
As a couple have over the years.
I'm not going to go there.
No!
Not going to go there. Yes. If there's a dead director out there... yes. Anyway, well... Well, I was very lucky. When I first got in touch with Caversham, this was about 11, 12 years ago, before I even had a publisher, I was helping out a website, Scott Burdett's Doomwatch website, and I sort of wrote to them, and he'd already been there, because they'll let, if you've had a website or a book or a magazine or you're a student doing media whatnot, or your PhD, they'll let you in for free. If it's a commercial project, they'll charge a fee. Now, he got in because he had his website, and you could prove, demonstrably prove, got a website. And so I was helping out, so I could then say, look, I'm helping out with this website. I want to do some additional research. And they said, yeah, sure. So I did a day. Then I got my book deal, doing the Doomwatch book, and the Kit Bedler biography. So I had two reasons to go there. Plus, I had a publisher at that point who could say, yes, he's doing a proper book, so let him in. You have to sort of think, well, what can you see? Now, there's a lot of 1960s, 1950s production files you can access quite happily, whether TV drama or radio or anything, BBC policy, for example. But unfortunately, in the 1970s, it's much more sparse, Spartan. You know, there's no Doomwatch production file, for example. And loads of other programmes that you think, oh, you'd love to read. Doctor Who is quite well preserved, but the rest of the stuff you can't. But you can see writers' contracts up to a certain time and things like that. And it's hard to explain, really. There's loads and loads of things. All the scripts of practically every programme, every radio broadcast, it's heaven. The only problem is you've got so little time. You've got so little time to look at these gems. It's something like opening a file, seeing all this different sort of paperwork, different sort of typefaces, old-fashioned full scrap, carbon copies, all that sort of stuff. It's walking back in time. And there's me with my little phone on my camera going click, 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 click. And you have to have this little card saying copyright BBC in every shot, which you normally sort of have in every shot. But then again, I'm not going to put these things up online for everyone to see. They're all for me. And then if you're quoting, the usual rule, if you quote, you need to get clearance from them before you can publish.
Okay.
Just a few days ago, I got clearance to have published quotes from the Swizzlewick production file. So producers saying, we've got their scripts. What are we going to do? Things like that. And Mary Whitehouse, what are we going to do? You know, things like that.
How many researchers will be in there at any one time? not working on
it's different. Usually Wednesday, Thursday, Friday you're allowed in. When I'm there, there's normally about five or six other people. And it could be people like researching their family tree, you know, someone from their family.
Oh, wow.
Okay. I've seen that a few times, and people getting cross with the microfilm machines. And I've got cross with the microfilm machines myself on one or two occasions because they sort of go all over the place. They've got these brand new lovely machines now. They can email scans to you, but I don't do that because it's too time consuming. And it's gold, as you would say, it's gold dust.
Yeah.
It's one of those things you want the BBC, you know, if you want one thing to survive from the BBC, it's got to be the archives.
There's so many things I would like to do, just trying to do them in the right order at the minute.
And time.
Time. Yeah, that's the thing, isn't it? When, you know, we're self-employed TV historians trying to make ends meet.
I've got a full-time job as well. So yeah. When your second job's more like a pleasure to do. Not a hobby, but suddenly it becomes much, it's endurable. I mean, when I moved a year ago, I moved into this place, I decided I really wanted to go ahead with this Saturday morning press, and I wanted my Swizzlewick, my R3, which is another 1960s science-based program, which I want to write about because it's sort of Doomwatch connected. And I wanted to do all sorts of other things. Coming home, I just went straight into it. I didn't feel tired. I just went straight into it, getting all this stuff done, and then go for that tedious editing process you have to do and make sure that you've written English. But it doesn't become a slog. I can't describe the process. It's just cathartic. I hate that word. That's what Pip and Jane Baker did back in the 80s for Doctor Who fans there. It's just a wonderful, wonderful process. And when you start to see it come together and you think, yeah, this is actually going to see the light of day. Someone else is going to read this and hopefully get something from it.
Well, how did it begin for you? I mean, Saturday Morning Press is a new venture, but I mean, you've written far more books than I have. I mean, how and when did the process begin for you? And when was the light bulb moment for, I could do this?
I saw this website about Doomwatch, which was my big thing, Doomwatch. And I wanted to help because I realised he must have had access to these scripts of the missing episodes, which I wanted to read. And I've been wanting to read for 20 years. So I sort of left some bait on the forum, which was basically like two people. And so I left that bait, and the next day he replied and said, would you like to help? And I said, cool, yeah. And it all started from there for about a year, helped to the site. And then one day I thought, hit Peddler. You know, we're just having great fun just researching anything left, right, and centre. He went to Caversham, we'd scour the internet, scour books, any reference to Doomwatch, boop, and it goes on the website. You know, nothing too trivial. And the more I was digging into Kit Peddler, I realised this guy needs a decent biography. And I thought, well, I'll give it a go. I sent an email to Annika Wills, who was then represented by Hearst Books, they were publishing her life story, and said, you know, you often tell a story about Kit Peddler and Jonathan Miller at a dinner party not getting on or something, just as a sort of, you know, just get one story. And instead of her replying, because she hasn't got the internet, it was the publisher, and he said, would you like to be published by me? I went, would I?
Wow.
Well, that's it. Would you like a Doomwatch book? And he said, yeah, that'll be all right, next to my book on the saint that's forthcoming. And so, yeah, great. Then I never heard from him again. The poor guy, I think, was overworked. And he just sort of retreated in on himself. I don't know the full details, but I do remember it got quite nasty on forums, people saying, I ordered a book and 5 minutes ago and it still hasn't arrived. Mm. And they didn't really give him a break. But, well, and I was getting upset because I was getting the family on site. They were Kit Peddler's family. They're getting a complete stranger to dig into their loved one's life. And I was thinking, is this actually going to happen now? But then I got in touch with Matt West's lot of Milk. Went from there, and then suddenly did these three books, including the script book, which I reprinted. And that went to the Douglas Canfield book. And then I sort of went on to a different publisher to do a different version of the Doomwatch book, and then onto Phantom. Then I thought, might as well do it myself.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you learn so much working with different people, don't you? When you realise...
You learn what to do. You also learn what not to do.
Yeah.
Through their bitter experience. And sometimes for your own. And so you learn what not to do and what to do. And hope for the best. And I'm in a position where I can take a loss. So if these books don't break even, well, you know, setting up a company is quite expensive. It's not cheap. printing is not cheap. Getting proofing is not cheap. You have to sort of do your research trips sometimes, you know, like not just Caversham, but I went to the University of Sheffield to look at the scripts of Keith Dewhurst, because he wrote an episode of Doomwatch which was never made. And all his paperwork was now deposited at that library. So I went up there to have a look at it. It was quite a nice day trip, actually, up from Norwich, where I lived, up to Sheffield and back again. And then sort of reading the script and going, ah, that's why it was never made. Okay.
Right.
Yeah. It was a good script, but it wasn't Doomwatch. It was a good script, though, but it wasn't.
Right.
And that's been printed in the Deadly Dangerous Tomorrow book. That's quite exciting. I was tracking down all these estates again and saying, will you let this happen again? And here's a fee. You've got to pay a fee. And yeah, they're all happy, all came on board. Very flattering.
Do you have to pay the BBC anything? Do the BBC still... So they don't own those writers... scripts.
Great thing about being in touch with the written archives is I can ask for advice. And when this was first published years ago, someone else did all this legwork. And so I said, look, what's the situation? Here's scripts to missing episodes, which you can't commercially make money from. It's from a series from 50 odd years ago. The estates of the writers, in the case of Keith Dewhurst, he's still with us. They all say, yes, what's the situation? They said, the BBC, and the 3 months later, I got a reply. They sort of sent it to the various departments, and the answer was the BBC has no objection, providing the rights holders don't object. So there you go.
Wow.
So yeah, you need to get clearances. At the moment, I'm trying to clear scripts for the second volume.
Okay.
Oh my God, blimey, Governor. I mean, some of the estates are like long since the writers died, like in the 1980s, and they had no children, but they had nieces and nephews. And their understanding of the situation is that the rights are now owned by Oxfam because of the will left by someone. And because in those days, writers didn't think that their work would make money in the future. You know, you had like perhaps a repeat in the same year, and then you might have an overseas repeat, perhaps a few residuals, and then after about 5 years, that's it. Your work is extinct. It's never going to be exploited in any other way, they thought then. And so the writers had that in their mindset as well, I suppose. And books, not every book's like reprinted on endlessly. It stops at some point, and you become a secondhand edition in some secondhand bookshop, don't you?
Yeah.
You know, you're lucky if you're continually reprinted. There are ways and means of bypassing this, and if estates are totally extinct and there's no one who claims the rights and who you can't pay a fee to or ask permission from, you can get a license, apparently. I won't have to do that just yet, but there's a couple of estates. Oh, my word. They're going to be fun to track down. But I'm halfway through. I've got two permissions. I've got one which I'm pretty sure is going to go my way, but I need to sort of check a few things first. And then there's a few that's pending replies, which I'm sure I'm going to get. And so, yeah, fingers crossed, it should be another edition of the Doomwatch Missing Episode Script Book. If I could get permission to quote from the files, then you just paraphrase. I paraphrase a hell of a lot, and they can't give permission for all. So all they're concerned about is copyright, and that you're not. If you're directing, you can quote like a couple of paragraphs or a couple of sentences, but if you're going to quote whole pages, that's a different kind of fish.
Absolutely,
you can't do that. I remember being in Caversham once, and I'm hearing a student saying, having this explained to them. So what? I mean, I can't quote all this. And go, well, no. And I said to him, what? You just paraphrase, you know, quote a few lines, then summarize what was said next. You don't have to go into such huge detail. You often find when you often find this that when you're writing these things, you need to know when to stop. You need to know when to cut back. You need to know, you know, this is a really fascinating stuff for you, but for the reader, you know, it's like, do I need to know all this? The one bit of advice I always remember from A-levels is the teacher saying, when you're doing your essay, are you answering the question? You know, you're writing about 17th century steam engines or whatever it is you're doing. You know, you don't start talking about 15th century windmills. You're talking about, unless it's relevant, you're talking about the subjects and the paper and the question. That's what I do with all my books, all my articles and things. Am I answering the question?
What's like, you know, you have these moments as a researcher, don't you, where like something just seems impossible, and then you get a real random in or avenue to explore, and you get this huge result. Do you have like a favorite, like the most weirdly wonderful bit of research or something that happened or a way to find someone that's happened on your...
It's when things connect together. I can give you an example. I once saw a reference to something called, when I was doing the Kit Pedler biography, I saw a reference to something called the London Science Group. I thought, who are they? And it's a connection with something to do with, this is back in 1970 when academia and places were starting to look at alternative ways of living, which didn't involve nuclear energy, pollution. They want, you know, they wanted a new science that was less harmful to the planet and to ourselves, so we don't have to breathe in pollution and die from emphysema and stuff like that. And it was over but time, I was discovering more links and more people and things, and then I was able to tell the story of that particular section of Kit Pedler's life, and I reasonably guessed a lot of it. And then I got invited to a conference in London celebrating 30, 40 years of alternative technology since the day that term was coined. And I met some of these people who were at that London Science Group, and one of them had their manifesto, as they called it, and gave it to me. That was just extraordinary. I was able to have a good chat with these people as well and sort of say, no, I'm doing this book. And I was able to give a 10-minute talk on Kit Pedler. And I was in this place called the Architectural Association in Bedford Square in London. Now, any Doctor Who fan will tell you that Bedford Square was in the War Machines. That's where the TARDIS lands. And I could see that spot from the window. And that was Kit Pedler's first ideas-based Doctor Who. And I was speaking from a podium that he stood on in 1970-something, talking about windmills generating wind power. So I was there suddenly thinking, I'm in Kit Pedler's spot. I'm researching his life. I'm talking to people who knew him. And there's where the TARDIS landed in 1966. I think that was one of those, yeah, I like my life type
yeah.
moments. But yeah, that was one of those sort of wonderful moments. It's when people actually agree to help you. That's wonderful. You know what it's like when you say someone from the Bill's past says, yeah, of course, I'd love to be interviewed about it. And they'll go on at length. It's wonderful. If anyone who says yes.
I had that with all memories when, you know, I interviewed Carol Drinkwater.
Oh.
And she said, have you chatted to Chris and Tim, meaning Robert Hardy?
Yeah.
I said, well, no, not sure. I'll ask him for you. You know, I was like, wow, you know. And
yeah.
You just, what a gift, you know, to have someone put a word in for you. And
yeah.
My favourite research story is the toughest person I've ever tracked down to find.
Yeah,
Was for the Dixon of Doc Green DVD special features.
Oh, yes.
And from that last series, four of the five regulars were still alive. And I'd interviewed Richard Heffer, Nick Donnelly and Stephen Marsh. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't find Ben Howard. Ben Howard was Hinks in The Green Death.
Yeah.
Doctor Who fans listening. And, you know, he was great in Dixon Doc Green, brilliant actor. His last telly was 1991.
Mm.
And I found his old agent from an old edition of Spotlight and said, do you have any forwarding? He said, I haven't spoken to Ben since the year 2000. If you find him, can you let me know? Because I want to talk to him. I thought, oh, blimey, okay. And everyone I spoke to with similar connection, no one heard of him. And Michael Bryant, the director, recalled that Ben Howard had become a skateboard designer in the 80s, and in the 70s rather. And he said, oh, and it was this terrible flop. He used to make them on his kitchen table, a terrible flop, you know. And I remember being in bed, it was like Christmas Eve. And I thought, was it a flop? You know, what if it wasn't a flop? And I looked up and it was called the Benji Board. And I found a Facebook page for the Benji Board with an animated drawing of Ben Howard. And I was like, oh, fuck. And I jumped out of bed and said, Tess, I think I found him. And this was where Facebook's a lot easier to contact people you don't know now. There was no way of like messaging this page directly then. It was just a page, you know.
All right, yeah.
And it hadn't been populated in a long time. And But on there was a video of a 1976 television commercial for the Benji board being modelled by a skateboarder called Mark Sinclair. And I thought, I wonder if I can find Mark Sinclair.
It was, isn't it?
I found him. He was a gardener in the Kyoto Garden in Holland Park. And I rang them after Christmas. I rang them and said, I'm trying to find, do you have a gardener called Mark Sinclair? She said, oh, I can see him out the window. I'll go get him. And I explained who I was. And he said, well, if you go to my Facebook page, you'll see on my friends list Max Howard, and that's Ben's son.
Oh.
If you message him, I will tell him what you're trying to do. And then his son introduced me to Ben, and I sat down and Skyped with Ben, and he lives in Australia. Their daughter had moved out there in 2000. They'd gone to visit her for the first time. They fell in love with it, and they never came back. They just thought, fuck it, we're going to move out here, and they're still out there. Well, I told him the agent was still looking for him. And after we did the interview, Ben emailed me and said, I don't know how to thank you, Oliver. My agent had been sat on 15 years worth of residuals.
Ooh.
You've given me my pension.
Wow.
And I was like, wow. And Acorn DVD, bless him, moved the release date of the DVD back so that I could get this man on the DVD. And we did a commentary, which was just great event. They were wonderful. And I hoped it would have continued, but these things didn't sell well enough for them anyway.
They should have done just the whole lot, the whole what's left of Dixon in one big box set.
Well, because we were planning a fourth, which was going to grab everything else that was left, because there was an episode. They've got an episode in the archives which is picture only. There's no audio on it. And Nick Donnelly, we were going to get him to do like an audiobook version where he read the script over the pictures. It was going to be so exciting. And just never happened. But these things have started popping up on YouTube. You've seen all the Zed cars popping up on YouTube
recently. Yeah, Heath Green account, and I think he's been taken off now.
Ah,
he was doing loads of two-parters.
Yeah.
From 67, occasionally John Levine pops up in him.
That's right.
One episode, it begins with him going, bah, 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 bah. I think, oh, probably it's John Levine.
Yeah.
I know, it was nice those two-parters did turn up. But I have to say, the two-parters I saw when I was researching Douglas Canfield's book, someone sent me all that survived of Douglas's work, which hadn't been released on VHS, on DVD. So that was wonderful. And that included some of the Zed cars, the Bill's Forerunner. When it was a twice weekly serial, and I have to say I wasn't really impressed. Even though Douglas Campbell was directing him, I wasn't really impressed with the stories I saw. It was only like one and a half episodes I was watching, and then I caught some more which just popped up randomly on YouTube. And I just didn't think much of these 25-minute jobs. I think because the cast just there was no Barlow, there was no Watts, the good ones. There was no Brian Blessed. Jimmy Ellis is great, but I don't really see him as a leader. And the guys they put in to replace Barlow and Watts, they just didn't have it. Just goes to show how unique Barlow and Watts were. The actors, Frank Windsor and Stratford Johns, just shows how unique they were in inhabiting those roles.
Well, I've grown to love John Slater. When I first watched the Zed Cars, I didn't find him. But now, I mean, he's great. All these grumpy put-downs and don't touch him. You don't know where he's been. I just love it.
Yeah, I imagine once he's got going, he's probably quite good. But I seem to remember watching some of the 70 episodes of him in it. But I have to say, I just don't find Zed cars in the later years sort of grabbable. They got a very distinct style of storytelling as well. Dixon has a very distinct style of storytelling, I think. I'm not saying it's basic ABC, but it's less complicated. The characterizations are less complicated than you'll get in other series. But I'm very fond of Softly Softly. I'd love to see more of the original run of Softly Softly before it became Task Force. The first two series of they came out on the DVD, didn't they? And then sadly didn't release the others. But then every now and then the whole lot gets put on YouTube. And if you're quick enough to download and pick them up again, then you can watch them and hey, I love them. But even they can be quite the writers were really schooled in the 1950s, and they were still writing 1950s-style stories, slightly updated, of course, in the 1970s. And there's one which is an end-of-series climax, end of the third series, where the Welshman, David Meredith, is he? He's great, he is, but... He's one of the old-fashioned cow glazers, which is like a one of those ones, you know, you don't doom watch, you think, cool, high tech.
Yeah.
He's watching his colleague, who's played by the chef from Fawlty Towers.
Oh,
he was the station adjutant, I think. He was always like the secretary, if you like, of the task force. Has a gold pen, and for 10 minutes, this guy is doing his calculations and sort of glancing at his friend, who's got the pen, and that leads to this corruption storyline where he's taking a few quid from a publican, and that's an end of series cliff. Oh my word. Barlow has to give him a dressing down at the end of the episode, and it's, you think, oh come on, can't you be a bit more exciting than that? That's probably unfair to say, well, this was probably edge of the seat stuff back then.
Well, I suppose I'm the researcher in me just finds myself fascinated, even when watching these old Zed Cars of Dixons, and even I suppose I'm more, as I've got older, I'm more forgiving, because I'm thinking, how did they do that? And like, oh, they've had to play that in on telecine, and yeah. I'm just like, I'm enjoying the process of how they must have made it is like an extra level, and sometimes you get a real cracker.
Without a doubt, yeah, there's some great episodes of Softly Softly, for example. But what got me was the series department must have been really cash-strapped, or they were just spending it all on actors' fees, which is normally the most expensive thing in any production. There's one episode which featured a train crash, and the train crash is a bloke on a bike looking slightly puzzled towards a sound effect coming over the hills, and that was it. Then it was cut to some stock footage, some really bad, grainy stock footage of... bad taste, actually, and it must have been a recent crash because it was color footage, and that was it. That was the train crash. They didn't think, let's get in touch with the visual effects guys and see if they can make something that we can quickly cut to show a train derailment or something. It doesn't have to be like 5 minutes long, just sort of quick glimpses, but they didn't, you know.
I'm enjoying would you believe, for the first time, Blake 7 at the moment. For the first time,
really.
Good
Lord. I've heard of people like you.
Yeah.
In the genes, I understand. That's a line from a Blake 7. we get to that one.
I mean, Star One the other night, I had to applaud. I just thought it was phenomenal. Watch him with Tess, and like Paul Darrow turns and shoots this guy, and his whole chest explodes. And I'm like, this was on at the same time EastEnders is
8
on
o'clock.
Now.
o'clock. It must have been 8 o'clock because it's 20 past 7 to 10 past 8.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Wow.
But to me, the most shocking bit in that episode is when Avon says to Blake, I've had enough of this. You know, I want the Liberator. Bugger off, you know. Blake says, you really do hate me, don't you? Yeah, it's that's for me was always the thing about Blake 7. Plus, it was so nihilistic. People died at the end of each episode. Hello, I'm this week's guest star. She'll be dead in 35 minutes time.
Yeah. It's so good. It's and I suppose we're lucky that, you know, we have fallen in love with shows that haven't had the Doctor Who treatment, the Blake 7 treatment, where fellow historians have been there and got in there. I mean, the Bill was just... I mean, there were official releases back in the day, but nothing to the level of detail that and I have gone into. But then these things are mass released and probably sold 10, 12 times as many as we'll ever sell in our lifetime. But they've probably got 10% of the content that we've put in, and, you know.
But you say that, I remember picking up books like, I'm not interested in EastEnders, but there was a really good book, I think Julia Smith wrote it, which was basically the sort of behind the scenes of how they sort of put the show together. And she was quite candid about the things that went wrong, like the original casting of Angie Watts and things like that. That was pretty darn good stuff. Sort of details like, when she had the set constructed, the outside set at Elstree, she went to visit the Sherlock Holmes set in Granada. And she said, I suddenly realised what I always felt was wrong with the Granada set. It looked too brand new. So she phoned up the designer and said, lots of weeds, lots of cracks, lots of plaster falling down, things like that. And it was those sort of details that I found absolutely fascinating.
Yeah.
And what was the other book? Oh, yeah, I suppose Inside Blue Peter. It was published for one of the anniversaries. And again, very candid account of behind the scenes of Blue Peter and of the presenters who didn't make the grade and how things went wrong and things went right. And again, that's really good. So you could get books like that.
They have to be looking back, don't they? There has to be a passage of time.
Mm.
The nostalgia element, but also the this isn't a press office approved,
yes,
you know, scripted.
But at the same time, I think they were slightly official. These books were official, but they were allowed to be candid.
Mm.
And surprising. And in that sort of detail, I can imagine the other sort of editors going, oh, come on, Joe Public isn't going to want to be interested in this, you know, which is rather insulting to, if you're going to buy the book, I imagine you are interested in it, you know. When I was a Doctor Who fan, there was DWB, which was a very critical, but also went into other programmes other than Doctor Who. And then they decided to become a sort of a mainstream thing. And they dumbed right down. And it became, you think, oh, because it's to attract a wider audience, of course. You think, well, the audience are going to be interested in this sort of stuff anyway. Why dumb it down? It's like an archaeological magazine just having features on what a trowel is every week, rather than talking about stratification of medieval layers and things like that. So I think.
Yeah, I mean, the more granular the detail, the better for me.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I'm currently just beginning going through 60 box files of Bill archive paperwork, which have been donated to me. Heaven on earth.
Let me tell you something that really bothered me when I used to watch the Bill, when I watched it live at the time rather than in later years, is that whenever they had the firebomb, no one ever screamed. That sounds gruesome, I grant you. But when poor Ben Roberts had that petrol bomb thrown into his car,
he
put his arms up in front of him. I don't know about you, I've been screaming my tits off.
Yeah.
And I thought it would be pretty harrowing because he is a character who'd been in it for about 20-odd years already at this point. He was brilliant because he was so realistic in that sort of, I was thinking of an episode today. For some reason, he's out on the beat or he's out in the car and he gets caught up in some domestic situation. And at the end of each scene, he just sort of rolls his eyes to heaven just to go, oh, what on earth am I doing in this? But he saves day, he sorts it all out, but he doesn't want to be there. And that is such a realistic approach. And they killed him off like that.
What's your favourite era and what's your not-so-favourite era?
Well, I can actually, I'm going to make an absolute confession here because when I first saw the Bill, I hated it.
Ooh.
I would have been 12 or 13. And I remember sort of tuning in to see one of the 50-minute Galloway episodes. And I hated the fact it was outside broadcast cameras. I hated the fact it was in people's living rooms. I hated the fact that the actors were so realistic because we were so used to melodrama. You know, watch a Juliet Bravo. They've had their 10 days in rehearsals. They're acting every line. They're performing every line. In the Bill, they're being that character. They're being real. And I couldn't quite cope with that because television wasn't quite getting that way. The Bill, I think, was probably one of the first to really... I remember watching when they repeated Wooden Tops as part of the anniversary celebrations one time. I can remember watching the guy who played Pete Beale.
Peter Dean.
It's one of the characters, and it cut to another scene. And I just thought, now that is just so... That suddenly it was... The Bill, which was then, was not as realistic in its acting, I'd argue. Pascal didn't have the time to do it as he had done then. So, you know, so over the years, I thought, I was a teenager, I wasn't really glued to television. Well, I preferred thrillers or fantasy or anything like that, along those lines. And the Bill, when it became a twice weekly or thrice weekly, I'm not going to say soap because it wasn't a soap, was it? For its
it wasn't meant.
Procedural police television. And it wasn't really the sort of thing I wanted to watch. But every now and then I'd catch one. I thought, yeah, that was good. I wasn't revolted by it. And sometimes you see people like Polly Page, and you go, hi. Hey. Yeah. Hi, Polly. And I remember one episode, there was, someone got killed off, and I can't remember whether it was the woman who got shot.
Martella.
Thank you, Martella. Oh, she's brilliant. When I was talking about realism and acting performance, she epitomises that in the second series. Yeah. Do you remember the one where there's a beginning of a scene of the second series where they're all marching in to be briefed, and they're all doing their little bit of improvisation, and they're so realistic, they're so real. You're there. This isn't acting. This is real. That wonderful scene of they're walking down the street. We've talked about this. It's like a 5-minute shot. The camera's on them from up high, and it's real. You're eavesdropping. That's the whole point of the camera work, isn't it? You're sort of watching, you know. Never mind what they did in the ER when it was like over the shoulder and back of the head all the time. This was proper sort of spy on the wall documentary. You're there in the room. You're sort of looking around. That's the camera work. That's the direction. And that's so realistic. And that put me off in those days. So, yeah, the Bill, I was always sort of popping in and out of the Bill. But the period I remember sort of starting to follow was the fall of CID, as I've seen it called on fan sites. Don Beach. And I love, who's the one Don Beach murdered?
Oh, John Bolton.
John Bolton.
Played by Russell Bolter.
Brilliant. He is brilliant because he was such a grumpy git. And he was forever having to learn a lesson at the end of certain episodes. And he didn't give a monkey. The result was ended. I loved him to pieces. And he's such a great character. And he sort of pulls up voice saying, my fault. You know, when one of the characters got stabbed, they blamed it on him, didn't they?
Yeah.
I think I remember it correctly. That was a great series of stories. So I remember tuning in for them and then being quite surprised when he gets killed in the manner that he did. And then the CID was then practically closed down and they all got their marching orders. Anyway, so then after sort of going, because I was working or with partners or doing things, then I came back to the Bill when they were bigging up the first big explosion where they're going to wipe out half the cast. It's awful. See, I mean, some of these characters you've seen for years, you know.
Yeah.
And then suddenly they're getting rid of... Ben Roberts, I think he go first?
Yeah, he went first, and then later in the week, Colin Tarrant.
Yeah, that was a big shock. I mean, he didn't even get a decent ending. He just sort of he had the money. He went walked around the corridor, and that's the last we saw of him. How disrespectful! I mean, they could have given these people some decent exits or realistic exits.
Well, the extraordinary thing is in that scene, the last time I see him, he's on the phone trying, and the line's dead. And standing the distance I am here to, you know, my door of the study, is a character who survived. With no explanation as to how this sergeant survived, but the inspector stood right in front of him, survived. You know, didn't
survive. Yeah, I mean,
fireball going through the
station. All those cylinders exposed. It's almost like the fireball went up the corridor, down up the stairs, and whoop, out of CID. You know, that's how it looked like to me.
Yeah, yeah. Definitely. It was great bit of CGI for its time.
You know? Was it?
Yeah, the flame going through the corridor shot was CGI.
I thought that was a model or something.
And then the practical explosion. Yeah, that's a great... Yeah. I should try and find who did that, because it was quite for its time.
I remember following the series from then on, you know, I was on and off whenever I could. But when I started to fall out of it was when they brought in Tucker from Grange Hill. Now, I loved the storyline when he was trying to do vigilantes in the estate and it started to go a bit pear-shaped on him. And they were supposed to take the law into their own hands, and he lost control and he had to sort of beat. Now, I loved all that. I thought it was a very clever idea, very good. But then when it became all that I am your son, Luke, storyline, when all that happened, and then worse, when I know you've recently had her as a guest, they brought in Kerry. Now, yeah, the problem with Kerry is, hi, I'm Kerry, I'm the new PC, whatever. Now then, I should be dating you this week, and I should be dating you next week. I think I'll be dating you and you at the same time. That's all we should be talking about. Please proceed, And we've discussed this before. There's that dreadful, dreadful episode where the bloke's got a bomb on him, and they're supposed to be looking after him and calming him down. They discuss their bloody love life, running out in and out of shop. What the hell were the writers thinking of? Might as well just say, we're not perfect. This is not real. We're not real policemen after all. And I don't know what the actors must have thought about this. They could have looked at that script and thought, this is how professional policemen behave. They're more worried about their bloody private lives. I thought it was an offence for policemen and women to be having relationships in the same nick. I mean, June Ackland, she had a relationship, didn't she, with a guy? And he had to leave quite early on in the series.
That's right.
When she got shot by Tucker, and then I just thought, that's it, I've had enough of this. But I just thought, I can't be asked for this anymore. Mm. How many nutters are there in the Nick? At one point, you had Kathy Bradford.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I could forget of anything. No. All right, so you killed that person. You're but hey, Kathy, you're lovely. You know, come on. No. She was great. No, she was really good, wasn't she?
Oh, fantastic actor.
The final scene with Polly. And I wish I could remember the line. But since it's almost like Hannibal Lecter, you know, she's at the back of that room and Polly's in the foreground and she said something, when's the last time you saw Jesus or something like that? And you think, that was really, really good, you know. And one thing you cannot criticise is the sheer technicality of the programme. The camera work, the stunt work, I mean, the sheer logistics of making, what, 2 or 3 50-minute episodes a week. Getting your actors around, getting all your stunt casting done, all your driving. The camera work is magnificent. It's just a wonderful exercise. I love to have worked on it. It's not like a soap like Coronation Street or Emmerdale where you've got your set and you're basically running around there. They're going all over London. But here's the thing I love about the Bill. When you watch about those first episodes, the Galloway episodes, Sun Hill, I think, is like three streets and Tower Bridge. And it's like three or four coppers. You know, but by the time we get to the period, I'm criticising. It's a huge station. There's like dozens of policemen about. And every week, this is what just made me laugh. You knew that every episode would begin with CIDs mounting an operation. And every week they seem to be culminating some cooperation that they've been going on for. How many cases were they working on?
Yeah.
Sun Hill, such a crime-centric area. With everyone, I remember when after the big explosion, they brought in one or two characters. They all seemed to have relatives in Sun Hill. And so everyone lived. Was there anything outside Sun Hill? You know, it's the thing I love most about the Bill was that they never wasted their time with the villains at home, sitting around a kitchen table, stuffing their face like they always had to do in Softly Softly or Zed Cars with bacon and eggs, and always eat with their mouths open. You can tell a villain by the way they eat. They eat with their mouths open, they're villains. I couldn't stand all those scenes. I sort of fast forward through them, frankly, sometimes on a repeat viewing, because I don't want to. It's always the same old dialogue, and there's always the same accents as well. You know, I'm a Cockney villain, me, and I'm eating my bacon and eggs, and we're going to play the next job unless Lily Law grab her. Oh, piss off, you know. And we didn't get that with the Bill. That was fantastic. I think the first series you did. I only started re-watching The Bill when I was researching Douglas Canfield's book, the biography, because I had this attitude, I'm not going to watch just his episodes of any programme he directed. I wanted to watch other people's around it. So I'd watch the whole Sweeney to see how his episodes fit in style and see, can I spot a style and can I see how others did it and may not have done it right or, well, you know, whatever. And suddenly it was like the floodgates were released. I wanted to watch so much what I've been resisting for years. Network must have done and made a fortune out of me. God bless their souls now.
Yeah.
And then so suddenly I started watching Bills on YouTube. Sorry. I did buy some video DVDs for them. And so, yeah, so I started watching them in order, more or less. And sometimes I think, oh, let's go and watch the ones I remember, the ones I really enjoyed. And I find myself following for them. The Fall of CID is a particular favourite in the Bolton. I'm watching Bolton from beginning to end and seeing how some of these characters started. Like, I remember Don Beach's first episode coming through a line, talking to someone, and that was his first. And you think, we know what's going to happen to you, mate. That bloody ponytail at the end of the plane. What are you thinking of? I don't know. Might as well just say villain on your forehead, you know. But there's a period of the Bill I didn't really like when it seemed to be the Jasmine ad in the state drugs every week. Yeah, you think, oh, come on, carry something. It was probably quite realistic, but you think, oh, come on, have something a bit more different now, yeah, please.
It's interesting, depending on who the script editor was, or, you know, like how much humour you'd have, depending on who the script editor was.
Yeah. Oh, the humour. That's one of the strengths of any programme, is when you've got a good camaraderie of the cast. I'm thinking back to that second series, One of my favourite episodes where they have that indoor football match. It's brilliant. And again, Martella shines in that one. She says she wants to play, so she gets to play. And at the end of it, she comes skipping out. All those characters are all going, and she's like, and I just think that's just so realistic. It's just, that's what those three series, they really had that good realistic feel to them. And I was really impressed when I watched them. And I thought, yeah, this sort of turned me into, I can't say I'm a fan, but into a great admirer of the programme and want to follow it, and why I want to follow your podcast as well.
I am hugely grateful to you for your support of the Build podcast and Letter from Helvetica.
Oh, my pleasure. I'm always happy to help, because you always help me too.
This has been a delight. It's always such a pleasure to enjoy your company.
That's my pleasure.
I'm really excited to see what 2024 brings for you and for Saturday Morning Press.
Thank you very much. It's been a great pleasure.
Keep doing what you're doing, mate.
I'm going to. Take care, mate. Bye-bye.
My huge thanks to Michael for being so generous with his time, and even more so, of course, for his support of the Build podcast as a sponsor. Shop.saturdaymorningpress.co.uk is where you can find Michael's books, and as I record this, his second Doomwatch script book, and a book examining the 1960s BBC series R3, starring John Robinson and Oliver Reed, are both printing now. Head over to shop.saturdaymorningpress.co.uk to find out more.
The Build podcast is produced by Oliver Crocker. Brought to you in association with georgefairbrother.com, shop.saturdaymorningpress.co.uk, cityfiction.co.uk, and vanguardcomics.co.uk. The Build podcast is co-produced by Ben Adams, Glenn Allen, Rob Cook, Glenn Cooney, Georgina Dark, Sarah Kuiper, Bryony Kelly, Maz Mirabilis, Alex Mockler, and Simon Wolfe. Our executive producers are Isabel Allen, Ben Ashmore, Mark Bennett, Alana Dewar, Andrew Dyack, Paul Dunn, Tony Drury, Dan Evans, George Fairbrother, Luke Hegarty, Robert Hoger, Edward Kellett, James Ledain, Thomas Johnston, Lucy McNeil, Gary Moncur, Danny Morris, Steph Morris, Claire Norbury, Laura Pinney Fay, Alistair Wrigley, Michael Seeley, Tom Sherrington, Angel Stannard, Paul Statter, Patrick Stratford, Michael Weil, and Sarah Wendt. Huge thanks to all you lovely producers who make the Build podcast possible. If you'd like to add your name to the credits and support the podcast, join the investigation at patreon.com/TheBuildPodcast. I'll see you next time. Bye for now.